Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain. And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and Stitcher.
Ooh, we're moving up in the world. Today's guest is one of the most celebrated lyricists in the American musical theater. In just a few powerful words, he has articulated the joys of motherhood and the story goes on. Broken Our Hearts and Funny Bones with Crossword Puzzle and a personal favorite of mine asked us all to go boom chicka boom. From Nick and Nora.
Thank you, Rob. In addition to writing the lyrics to such shows as Starting Here, Starting Now, Baby, Nick and Nora, Miss Saigon, and Big, our guest holds a very unique record as well. In the history of the Tonys, only two reviews have ever won Best Musical, which are Ain't Misbehavin' and Fosse. And guess what, folks? He directed both of them.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Nell Carter, Arthur Lawrence, and David Shire, plus what it's like to craft the perfect review, here to take a moment to stop time is the Tony Award-winning Richard Maltby Jr.
Hello. You want me to contrast Nell Carter, David Shire, and Arthur Lawrence? I mean, nobody puts those three in a sentence.
We cannot wait.
Before we begin, we have to ask you, what exactly is a cryptic crossword puzzle?
When New York Magazine started, Steve Sondheim decided to introduce cryptic puzzles to the United States. So he did them. Cryptic puzzles were invented in England. They are crossword puzzles, in that the words go into the diagram, but instead of definitions, as American crosswords, they have clues. And the clue is something that looks like a sentence but really isn't. It includes a definition of the answer plus a subsidiary description of how to spell it, how it sounds, what it would be in reverse, or any number of other things. And then it's written together cleverly to mislead you so that you don't know which part of the sentence is which. And so it's an attempt to fool you into mislead you so that it takes you a while to figure out the answer. And when you do, it's usually witty, and you usually have, as Steve says, an aha moment.
Of course, yes.
Because the clues are really really fun. At least I set out to make them fun.
And you're still making them for Harper's Magazine?
For Harper's Magazine, yeah.
That's correct.
Have you always been a puzzle junkie?
No, I really wasn't. I did the Times puzzle, you know, and I did... I have a stunt, which is, you know, people like to say they can do the Times, Sunday Times puzzle in ink.
Yeah.
I can do it in my head.
Yes, yes you can.
I do it with no pencil or pen. I just look at it for about a half an hour and then cut out the diagram and just fill it in separately without looking at the clues.
Okay, that's impressive. Takes it to a whole new level.
No guest has been able to do that.
No, so absolutely not.
I'm sure that I'm unique in the world. But the thing about cryptics is that it's because the English language actually doesn't exist. There is no such thing as the English language. It's an entirely borrowed language. It's
right.
Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, French, Latin,
yeah.
Then all of Europe, and then Arabic, and then things from the Far East as colonialism came in. So there isn't, as a result, words in English have so many different meanings that you can, in fact, make somebody think that this is a verb when in fact it's want the definition of it as a noun, and that sort of thing. So, anyway.
Does the creation of the cryptic crossword puzzle in any way influence your lyric writing? Or,
well, it's interesting. The people that I know in the business who do them are Sheldon Harnick, Stephen Schwartz, what other lyricists?
Totally.
It's because lyric writing is a very technical use of language. You have so many syllables, you have emphasis here and here and here, so therefore you really have to know how to craft multiple meanings of words, into the smallest amount of space that you can come up with.
Which is like a puzzle in itself, really.
So lyric writing is like verbal puzzle solving anyway.
Right.
You have exactly what you want to say. But the musical line has two extra notes in it.
Let alone, yeah.
So how do you recraft the sentence so that it still says what you want to say, but it has those extra two notes in it? Or what you want to say is accented wrong.
Right.
You can plead with the composer to change the melody. Or, I don't like to do that. I just like to find another...
Make it work.
To make it work, yeah.
Who are some of your favorite lyricists?
Well, someone asked me recently, obviously Steve. But really the lyricist that I kind of most admire and wish I was is Sheldon Harnick, because of the simplicity and the wit and the warmth and the sort of humanity of his stuff. He is able to be so graceful and at the same time, deliver beautifully funny lines that don't seem to have any effort. None of his lyrics seem to display any effort. And the goal is, I think, if you take the music away, would you say the same thing? And that's my goal. And it works for most of the great lyricists. But a lot of us, you get into a hole and you can't really find exactly the right line, so you think you'll get away with it. And you stick it in.
Right.
And if you're lucky, you have a collaborator who says, that line over there, you don't really want, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you let it go.
Right.
You have the feeling that Sheldon never lets it go and is the simplicity and power of what he writes. Particularly in the great shows. I mean, I think She Loves Me is just perfect.
Yeah.
No argument.
Agreed,
here.
Yes. Yeah. That's. And, you grew up in Wisconsin?
No.
You were from Wisconsin.
I was born in Wisconsin.
And where did you grow up then?
Well, to the extent that it's happened at all.
Yeah.
My father was a trumpet player in a traveling band, so by chance, my mother's family lived in Wisconsin, so that's why I was born in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
I think I only lived there 2 or 3 months, and then I was packed in the back of a Plymouth and traveled around the country as the only baby in this traveling band.
And what was that like?
I don't know, but apparently I got a baby present from Sophie Tucker.
Oh.
How about that? That's pretty cool. The band that my father was playing with was accompanying Sophie Tucker. So I got a baby present from Sophie Tucker. It seems to have disappeared. I don't seem to have it.
Do you have any?
My other claim is that my father who was moved from being a trumpet player to an arranger, was the musical director for the only radio program that Ethel Merman ever did. So I was always in his studio, and the phone would ring, and I would hear across the room, "Hello, Richard! This is Ethel!" And my father would hold the telephone at arm's length, and we would just both laugh, and then he'd pull the phone to him and say, "Well, Ethel, I think, you know, a chorus and a half," and then modulate up, and then he'd hold the phone away while she would go, "Wow, wow, no, I think we ought to..."
It's true. I love it.
It's true. We went in and actually watched one of the radio broadcasts and went back and met her afterwards. She was entranced by my younger sister, who was 4 years younger, and she said, "Wait a minute." And she opened this gigantic purse that she had, and she came out with a small Tiffany box that had in it a solid gold yo-yo that was a sort of a charm bracelet, charm. And then she looked at me. I'm sure I was looking sort of hangdog. She said, "Oh, I have something for you, too." She went back in the bag and pulled out a plastic chicken that laid marbles that she got from Woolworths.
Wow.
I think she didn't think that there was any difference between the two. Those are my Ethel Merman stories right there. So Ethel Merman, Sophie Tucker.
She had those things just sitting around that she was like.
Now, being surrounded by so much music, did you know that you were going to go into the arts? Did you know that was going to be your path in life?
You know, I don't think I ever knew it. I had a marionette theater when I was small. I don't think I ever, you know, made a choice. I think it wasn't a choice that was ever made. I wanted to be a set designer, and that lasted until my second year at Yale when I discovered definitively that I can't draw. And I wanted to write musicals because they had better scenery. I did a show in prep school in my senior year, and then went to Yale to write musicals because they produced musicals and because they had a theater and Harvard didn't.
When did you first become aware of, you know, your father's played in more of a big band, let's say, kind of music?
Well, he wasn't actually. That was where he became famous for his band, because his first hit record happened to be a mambo when the mambo craze came in, uh-huh. which was a band arrangement. And as a result, there was suddenly a great clamor for this new band. Uh-huh. But in fact, what he really was a symphonic arranger. He did, I don't know if you know the name of Andre Castellanos.
Of course.
Oh, yes. But that was, yeah. You know, that, Percy Faith, that kind of, yeah. of particularly Andre Castellanos, those big radio orchestras. And so he was, when he moved from Chicago to New York, he was a staff arranger for ABC and NBC and arranged for the big symphonic radio shows, the Paul Whiteman show and all sorts of things.
Did you ever have the acting bug at any point?
I acted once in New York. I took an acting class, which was not really an acting class. It was it was sort of an adjunct of a therapy class, but it had an acting component. Well, it was an acting class. It was actually kind of astonishing, taught by a person who I don't think was actually very bright, but he was really smart about this one thing, and he knew these techniques to shortchange the physical impediments to producing emotion. That's really what it was, and that had obviously it has therapeutic therapy elements to it. But it also has acting elements. It frees you from the way that your body can, you know, holds back emotion. And there are incredibly complex ways in which we conceal who we are physically. So anyway, I did that. And Austin Pendleton, who I knew from Yale, was directing a play at the Manhattan Theater Club. It was a two-character play, and he, for some reason, had the idea that I should be in it. So he cast me in it, and... it turned out to be an hour-long two-character play that ended with a two-page monologue from my character. I thought, "Oh, wow!" Okay. It was quite an experience. I never before understood how powerful acting is, how powerful you feel when you're acting, how incredibly alert you are. You're not only playing the scene, but you're aware of the audience, you're aware of the lights, you're aware of sound, you're aware of laughter. You're just so incredibly alert, and how sort of exhausting that is. And for the first time, I understood why actors drink. I mean, come off the stage, and you go back to real life, and it's really it's a painful return. And can you imagine if you were, you know, playing Hamlet, and then you go home and you're just you know? Yeah. Nothing like a couple of belts to make that transition happen.
That's such an interesting point.
A couple of things happened, too. I was given a two-page, it was a play about a scavenger woman who just went around and found things and brought them home. That was what the play was about, but we never actually saw it. So after a week of the run, Austin and the author came in, and they had a two-page scene that preceded, that set up the play, in which she came home and actually delivered some of the things that she had found. And I knew this made perfect sense. I mean, it was an absolutely sensible thing to do. So we're in rehearsal, we're on the stage, and I started doing actor shit. I was like stamping my feet and saying, well, just tell me what you want. I don't know who I was. I was just irritated. Mm-hmm. I just was, you know. And even though I knew exactly why it was there and that it was really, a sensible thing to do, there I was being resistant. And suddenly I understood that the reason I was being resistant was not that I didn't like what I had to do, but that just a small... I had constructed in my head a logic from the beginning and the end of the play. And if you change the little beginning of it, you have to change, like, the ripples. You have to change everything that follows it. And I didn't want to do it. It was like, I was just, I didn't want it. But you had to change absolutely everything if the first page was different. And that made me understand that look that happens, that comes across an actor's face when you give them a revision. Mm. My brain always said, oh, my God, they're so smart. They know exactly how crappy this revision is. But that's not what it is. They're looking at it saying, what am I going to do with this? I actually have worked out something in which this doesn't happen. How am I going to do that? And how am I going to fit it into everything? So I suddenly, it had a great impact on me as a writer, because I suddenly could understand, what actors have to do with material.
When you were starting to write your lyrics and you were beginning this initial collaboration with Mr. Shire, did you also have the directing idea percolating as well?
Well, I never gave it a name, but yes. I wanted to create these musicals. You could always find people who could write the script. You could always find people who could write music. Nobody ever wanted to write the lyrics. So I became a lyricist because nobody ever wanted to write the lyrics. And I never wanted to be a lyricist. Who wants to be a lyricist? I mean, it's a terrible job. You're always off in the hotel room trying to fix those two bad lines, which if you had been able to write them, you would have written them badly in the first place. So I was just... when I got to New York after we graduated, and it suddenly hit me that I was a lyricist, that's what I was. And I was appalled. Why on earth would anybody want to do that? And then we had issues with shows that we did where the material, when it was done, didn't come off well for one reason or another. And I thought that was our shortcoming as writers. And it sent me into a tizzy, back on the therapy theme. And after a great number of years on the couch, it suddenly came clear that what I was sitting on was an impulse to direct. That is to say, I wanted to create the thing. I wanted to create the whole thing. I didn't want to just do one little part of it and not be responsible for more of it. So with that, I set myself a little training course to become a director, which involved basically saying yes to anything that came along. I did benefits and nightclub acts and one-man shows and created little projects that I could direct, just anything that, that came along. And it took almost 10 years, 9 years before I did Starting Here, Starting Now, which was, you know, David's and my material all put together. And then the year after that, Lynn Meadows said, we have a slot. Why don't you do that Fats Waller material you were talking about? Because I was working with a guy named Murray Horwitz about on a book musical about Fats Waller. But it sort of foundered because, as fascinating as his first act was, he died young and there's no second act. Right. He didn't go anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
So we dropped it. But I had all these kind of perceptions and ideas. And so... because I don't like review. The reason I do, I'm the king of reviews, is that I don't like reviews.
Isn't that ironic?
Well, and I think it's the reason why, because I don't assume that they're interesting. You know, I have to do something else to make it you know, interesting. So I was going to take all these Fats Waller songs, but I put into it all of the content that we were going that we were thinking of putting into the book musical. So Amos Behaven, while it seems to be one song after another, is just jam-packed with actual biographical information, emotional information, characters, comedy, all sorts of things that would be the basis of a book. I call it a bookless book musical, you know.
Because, yeah.
I mean, we've talked to many people, and we always tell our students that if you want to see a perfect review in terms of structure, you really need to look at Ain't Misbehavin', and everybody agrees on that, that is...
It is perfect, isn't it?
It is perfect.
I say with absolute humility, you know.
Yes.
So would you do us a favor, would you walk us through how you took all of these songs that were not written for any character to sing and gave it a world? So for example, Your Feet's Too Big.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come up in the rehearsal process? It's a standalone entertainment song, and you made a story out of it. How?
Well, it's actually a bigger issue than just that one song. How much time do you have? I can go on for endless hours.
Please, we will love it.
There were a lot of. I'll address the Feet's a big thing specifically, but it became clear that the comedy that was in the show, and the reason I loved, the reason I wanted to do the show in the first place was because of Fats Waller's comedy. But the more you looked at it, the more kind of radical it was, the more incendiary it was. I mean, he was constantly sending up pretentious people, rich people, white people. He was constantly... saying we're the equal of you, you know, and that was like underneath this, and he got away with it because he was so funny and because he was so endearing. But it was quite quite radical. And then as the show began to shape itself, the first half of the first act was who Fats Waller was. The second half of the first act is where the venues that he worked in. And then the second act expanded out to the greater world. And and that opened the door to the... I mean, these were artists of unbelievable talent trying to make their way in a world, in a hostile world, hostile environment. They didn't offer... The only way you could make yourself heard was to be so good they couldn't deny you.
Mm.
And so that's why the musicianship was so high, why the standards were so high. But there was prejudice out there, and it was not only racial prejudice. The world is full of lots of prejudices. One of them, I mean, we had... As a result of casting, we had two heavyset women and a skinny girl, you know. And so the world is prejudiced against people who are overweight or too skinny or too, you know, or the way they look. The world is prejudiced against what, you know, what you believe. What, you know, there are all sorts of prejudices out there. And once you start thinking of that, the Your Feet's Too Big is not just a funny song. It's about the guy who only gets half a plate. You know, other people get the full plate. Other people get the full meal. I get the half plate. Other people get the pretty girl. I get the girl with the flaw. Why? And so it became a rage much bigger than just a girl who's got big feet. Actually, it isn't about girl who has big feet at all. It's about, why is it that I don't get the good one? Yeah. Why I get the one with the big mole on her face. I get the girl that isn't that pretty, and the whole of the second act, although it's a lot of entertainment numbers, is basically about prejudice. You know, it's about living and it's how you deal with prejudice. With the one weapon that always wins, which was comedy, which was humor.
Yeah.
And if you go through it, song after song after song, they're all about dealing with the hostile world until finally the comedy mask comes down for Black and Blue, and then we resurrect the rest of the character. I mean, the structure of it, I can go on and on about.
No, it's fascinating. And did you know at the time that this would take on the life that it took on, that it would be the hit that it was, because it ran for almost four years, and that it would win the Tony? I mean,
we went into rehearsal with a cast. I had planned to have three people in the cast.
And let's just say who the cast was. I mean, we have Nell Carter.
Andre DeShields.
Ken Page.
Charlene.
Charlene Woodard, although it was originally Irene Cara at the Manhattan Theater Club, and Armelia McQueen.
Yeah,
I had expected to have just three people, because most of the cabaret shows at the Manhattan Theater Club had three people, and I wanted Alana Reed to do it, and she didn't want to do it, and she's the only one I knew, and so we had to have auditions. And then in came Armelia McQueen, this creature from another planet, this gigantic smile, this, you know, incredible face, and she had breathtaking soprano, and then she also sang belty jazz songs. I thought, oh my God, that's, you know. And then half an hour later, Nell Carter came in. And she sang, first she sang New York, New York. Oh, my God. And then, because she had, the instruction was to sing something from the 30s, we assumed it would be an American song from the 30s, she decided to sing Noel Coward's If Love Were All. And I have never heard it sung so breathtakingly, touchingly as she did. And so I was just in absolute despair, because I had to pick one or the other, and I couldn't figure out who to pick. And then weeks went by, and finally I thought, okay, cast them both and build the show to an 11 o'clock number in which they both hit high notes. Mm. At which point, it didn't matter what the show was, everyone's going to go home happy.
Totally.
So, I mean, literally, that was exactly my thought. And then I thought, since they're both sort of heavy set, cast Irene Cara, who is skinny, so the two of them would gang up on the skinny girl.
Totally.
And then cast only two men, not three, so that every woman who wants a man is going to have to break up a couple, which gave me the mathematical combinations of five, so that we have all sorts of twos and threes and battles and everything. And it totally fit into the dynamic of Waller's comedy, which was that you you never tell the truth. So anyway, we have these relationships in which everybody is jockeying for position. So we have a good set of plots going. Then Murray Horowitz knew that Fats Waller had made a few films called Soundies in the 40s, just after the war, at the end of the war. There were jukeboxes that also had a little film component to it. And for a quarter, you could not only hear the song, but you could actually see the movie. And he made one of several songs, but one of them was Amos Behaven. And we went to a guy who was a collector who had one of those West Side apartments jammed with walls full of stuff and everything. And he pulled out this thing, and we saw it. You can see it. Now it's on YouTube. You can see this exact thing, and you'll know what I'm talking about. There's Fats Waller singing Ain't Misbehaving to this pretty girl. Ain't misbehaving, I'm saving my love for you, and his eyes are going. And she's looking back at him going, oh, yes, oh, yes. And behind him are these three girls. And the three girls, every now and then, they come up and sort of touch Waller on the shoulder, and the girl bats him. You know, the girl he's singing to goes over and swats them, and they go away. And the other one comes over and touches. I'm thinking, what is going on here? What this great confession, this great vow of complete fidelity? Yeah. I thought, oh my God, Ain't Misbehaving is a lie. The guy singing it has been cheating like crazy. The girl he's singing to knows it. He knows she knows it. She knows he knows he knows it. And the subtext is, and what are you going to do about it? Because if I were so boring as to be faithful, you wouldn't be interested in me, would you? And she knows it's true. And then she goes over and flirts with the band and then comes back and she sings Ain't Misbehaving, I'm saving my love for you. And I thought, oh, my God. And then you realize that that's the basis of so much of the comedy all the way through through Waller's comedy, which is always to kind of cover up what's going. And then you realize what's actually comedy is actually covering up pain. The pain of being of a hostile world, the pain of being rejected. Let's say you are overweight and your man suddenly is playing around with that skinny girl. You don't say, oh, poor me. You say, oh, for heaven's sakes, honey, you want to go over and play with that hors d'oeuvre over there? You have yourself an hors d'oeuvre, and if you feel like a full meal, I may be here, you know. You don't say, if you go over there, you will break my heart. Right. That's not what you do. So the whole show suddenly acquired a comic tone, which years later I realized was restoration comedy. Mm.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Of the period, and he had another job at the same time. He was doing a tour of South Pacific, and they overlapped on the first week. And finally I said, okay, listen, you're in rehearsal. You've got one day off. I got that one. You also got the evenings free, right? So what happens if we rehearse afternoons and evenings? And I'll put the stuff together in the afternoons, and you can sage in the evening. And that's how we got through the first 2 weeks.
Wow.
We also, the guy who was going to be our musical director and do the arrangements, who was a stride piano player, turned out to not be a very good arranger. And so in the second week, we acquired Luther Henderson, yeah. who, of course, was brilliant because he's the... And he was an old friend of my father's.
Oh, no kidding.
So, you know, so and had been to my house. Wow. So, but he is probably the only person with one foot firmly in jazz and big band arranging, and the other firmly in Broadway. He was right. a Broadway orchestrator. Arthur Faria, yes, he knew all of the dances and the steps and everything of Harlem in the 30s, but he's also the only American who had ever studied at the Royal Ballet in Bangkok.
Wow.
So he knew the entirety of Siamese dance. So he invented, you'll notice all that stuff with the hands. That's all Thai. That's all Siamese. That's all Thai.
Wow.
That's the Royal Ballet of Bangkok, which he added to the basic moves of Harlem, inventing a movement style that was totally unique and unbelievably eloquent. So we had that, and then I did know at the end of the first day we played through some songs. I knew that we were going to do a handful of keys.
Love that one.
With all five people. Oh, I've left this out. The other idea we went into rehearsal with was, everyone knows that Waller's comedy, you know, he does these comic asides in his songs and everything. But there was a lot of piano music, pure piano music that he recorded. And that's just as funny. It's just witty. I mean, it's diddly 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 did dong diddy dong dong. He's just joking with you all the time musically, and I thought we have five characters, fingers of the hand. If the show could play with the audience the way the music plays with the audience, that's quite separate from the lyrics or the content. Yeah. If the show could tease you and joke with you from beginning to end, that would be something that would be useful and. So I had that idea as well. And I knew we were going to do Handful of Keys, and Murray Horowitz and I had written a lyric to it. I love writing lyrics to band arrangements, you know, where the different parts kind of go together.
Yes.
I also did, Jitterbug Waltz and that. But I knew that... In the structure, the Black and Blue was going to be the second to last song. What you do on the first day of rehearsals, everybody sings through the songs. And Nell Carter sang it, and that was wonderful. And Ken Page sang it, and that was wonderful. I was thinking, why should any one person be singing this song? It seemed wrong. And then... This is one of those magic things that happens because this show is so incredibly blessed. But the song is one line, two lines, three lines, four lines, a fifth line, and the title song, and the title line. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, title.
Perfect.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, title. So I knew that that was going to be something. And I knew these... I mean, Luther was going to do the arrangements, but he wasn't going to do the vocal arrangements. I knew I needed spectacular vocal arrangements for this and for Handful of Keys. And I called Steve Sondheim, and he said, I got this problem. You know, who do you know that I could get? He said he didn't know. And then the next day I got a cable.
A what?
He was... going to England on a boat, and I got a cable saying the best person for the job is Bill Elliott. So I called up Bill Elliott. Bill Elliott was, at that point, kind of impoverished. He was living in the village. Shortly developed shingles because he was from malnutrition. And I met him, and I thought, oh,
yeah, I think you're really smart. Yeah, I think you, but how can I can't, it's the second week of rehearsal. I cannot entrust these two really complicated arrangements to you. And I said, you know, I'm sorry, it can't be you. He was going out the door and I thought, but who else do I have? Right. And I thought, I got to do this. So I said, well, let's just go and look at Black and Blue. And so we pulled out the sheet music and Bill started to play it. Now, this is a show that starts with Ain't Misbehavin', which is the Comedy Central of the piece. And the end of it is Black and Blue, which is the comedy masks drops and you see what's the real pain that's inside. And the piano part goes, what did I do to be so black and blue? And the musical fill in the piano part is ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-bee-bee. The fill in Black and Blue was already Ain't Misbehavin'.
Wow.
Just meshing the two songs together in a way that, you know, you couldn't have dreamed to come up with. I mean, a brilliant arranger might have come up with it, but there it was, right there. And Bill said, well, there, you know, there it is. So I gave him that, and he went off for the rest of the week, did these arrangements, and in the third week of rehearsals, came in and taught these incredibly complicated arrangements, which he was sort of fixing and fudging at the same time. He drove the actors absolutely crazy. I mean, they had X's for eyeballs. I was happy that it took so much time because I hadn't constructed the second act yet. So while they were rehearsing, I was busy trying to get three steps ahead of them, you know, get the second act going.
My goodness.
And, but it got better and better. And at one moment, someone in the cast said, why are we working so hard on this? And I mean, this is a little nightclub show at the Manhattan Theater Club. The cast, every person in the cast was getting $125. Not $125 a week, $125 for 4 weeks of rehearsal and 4 weeks of performance.
Wow.
A total of $125. And it was Andre DeShields who said, no, he said, I think this is important, he said. And they all went back to work. And, of course, those arrangements are just flawlessly brilliant.
They really are.
Just absolutely breathtaking.
Oh.
You know, we slowly, you know, put the show together. There was a moment in that third week when I was putting, I had the first act pretty much laid out. I didn't know what to do with the second act, and I had it. I laid it out that it would be this, followed by that, and but I didn't have any confidence in it. And if anybody had walked in the room and said, "I know how to fix this show," I would have given the show away, totally. But I looked around, and nobody had a better idea than I had, and that was all we had. So we just did it. It's the second act that we have. I'm sorry, but it's just a perfect act.
It is
just absolutely perfect.
Yes.
It did have one extra element, though, that happened in rehearsal. We didn't, because their time was running out, we didn't really have an ending. And I knew I wanted them, the cast, to sort of move beyond the songs and become the band. But I thought that was going to be another X's for eyeballs arrangement that was, and I just didn't see how I could give it to them. We came up with we found some song and came up with a quick kind of gospel-y arrangement of it and thought that, well, that, you know, gospel, you'd always bring the curtain down with that. I didn't have much faith in it, but it was something that could end the show. So we went running into the rehearsal room and we, you know, presented it to the cast, and the cast just sat there. It was like no reaction at all. I know, again, it was Andre who said, you know, we didn't work this hard to end the show with that. And I almost burst into tears because I was so proud of them all, and because I knew how to end it. I knew that they had to become the band. And I talked to Luther, and he found a really easy way to do it. It was because Murray said that the one thing you do at the end of an evening of music with a band is you introduce the band. And the band were these great names, Gene, Honeybear, Cedric, you know, all of these great names. And again, the band was six people. It was five people plus Fats Waller. Wow. So every person in the band, every person in the cast became the trumpet. Well, of course, Nell was the trumpet. Yes. What else? Ken was the saxophone. Armelia was the clarinet. Andre was the bass. And Charlene was the drummer. And that allowed us to go and on piano, Mr. Fats Waller, which allowed us to do the concluding moment of the show, which is, hey, guys, this is all about Fats Waller. But you did it without seeing it coming, and the follow spot hit Luther Henderson at the piano, and there we were. These things were just magical, and this... The trajectory of the show was, we went into rehearsal on January 1st with a stack of sheet music. We rehearsed it, and we opened on February 1st after 4 weeks. We closed on March 1st. On April 1st, we went into rehearsal for Broadway. On May 1st, we opened on Broadway. And in June, we won every award you can win in New York.
I mean, like 6 months. What a good 6 months.
It was all 6 months.
And a lot of work, but...
You know, it was like, I mean, we were going to, they were building the scenery on stage during what I've had was my, I thought was my tech week. I was going to have, I had 1 week from Monday to Friday, and we were going to have a performance on Friday. I didn't get the cast on stage until Thursday morning. So we had to tech the show Thursday and Friday.
And when you say every award, just so our listeners are aware, this one, Best Musical.
Best Musical for the Tony Award.
Yes.
Yeah.
Drama Desk, Drama Outer Critics Circle, the New York Drama Critics Award, and because we'd opened off Broadway, an Obie. So,
Best Director for...
And I won for Best Director, and Nell won for Best Supporting Actress.
And every single review pretty much since then has tried to emulate in some way the structure that you created for Ain't Misbehavin', which is... And just to give our listeners some perspective, am I correct in assuming that most reviews at the time of Ain't Misbehavin' were pretty much, and then he wrote?
Something like that. They almost always had talk.
Yeah.
And I eliminated the talk because I thought it was boring. And they usually had comedy sketches. You know, a standard classical review had songs, dances, and comedy sketches. There weren't going to be comedy sketches, but then, you know, it was sort of... I sort of invented this with Starting Here, Starting Now. I took all the transitions and made the songs work as a story inside of themselves. So I had that kind of going for it. That's what...
And the idea also of dovetailing the end of one song to go into the beginning of another in terms of creating a thread or a story... which is now seen so much in showcases today. So you created something quite revolutionary,
right? I mean, it's not that obvious. I mean, most songs actually have endings, but it is structured that somehow the show always is ahead of your expectations.
Yes.
You always are in the next song before you realize you got there. You know, but I will tell you one. There's one other little anecdote that I love that. Told us how blessed we were. When we moved to Broadway, we were going to add a band, a real band, and I knew I wanted to do it only halfway through the act. I wanted the audience to feel like, oh my God, we're going to spend all evening with just a piano. And at the moment when they got really unhappy, we were going to introduce the band in a big way. Plus, dance halls, places were one of the venues that it would begin the whole section of places that he functioned. One was dance halls, one was radio remotes, one was rent parties, you know, and so so I knew we were going to do that. And Arthur had a dance that he had worked out in his head that he'd always wanted to do, where a kind of a rube tries to pick up a girl at a dance, and she's and it was the whole thing was going to be this purse that was swinging around as she whopped him, you know, one way or the other, and he had this idea for the dance. So we looked around to try to find something that Waller had written that we could, you know, use. And we came up with something that wasn't all that good. Now, we were also looking for a ballad in the second act, which we actually never ended up using. But and Murray Horowitz, who has this huge jazz collection, was walking through the village, found a record store that he didn't know, went in there, and there was a bin that said jazz, and he opened, and there was a jazz album that he had never heard. Oh my goodness, there's a Fats Waller album he didn't have. He bought it, took it home. He said, "I think I've found the ballad for you." And I went down, I listened to the ballad. It was okay. And it went into the next track, and the next track was, "How You Baby, How's About a Little Dance?" About a rube picking up a girl at a dance. Not only that, but even though it was written in the 20s, it's written like a modern book song. Yeah. It's a dialogue song. Songs aren't written like that. Yeah. If I had gone off to write a lyric, you know, to make that song happen, I couldn't have come up with anything. And so I am convinced that the next day, if Murray went down that same street, the record store wouldn't exist, and that it was, you know, Waller saying, "I know what you need. Right. I'm going to send it down exactly. to you." You know,
that Mike, is no, just incredible, absolutely amazing. So that experience happened, and you were not you directed that, and it worked. Now you went back to book writing. I mean, you collaborating on a book musical. Let's say.
Well, yeah, big. Dave. I mean, that, you know, it wasn't.
I mean, baby. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I was not going to be a review. That was not my idea of what you do.
No, you got to change it up.
Yeah, no. David had gone off to California and had become because right. the work was just flooding in for him as being a film composer, and I was busy pursuing my little directing career and. So we hadn't worked together. We did some work, you know, and we weren't like split up, but we weren't really working together.
Right.
And we were still looking for an idea for a musical. And David was in the car with, I get to be name dropper, with his then brother-in-law, Francis Coppola.
Yeah, nice.
And was saying, "Well, I don't know what to, you know, what should I do?" And Francis said, "Well, what's the most important thing that's happened in your life? You know, what's the most moving thing?" And he said, "Oh, it's the birth of my son." And, you know, a big symphony orchestra went, ba-dum.
Yes.
Like, I guess that's totally. The idea. So he came to me and he said, "I think this is what we ought to do." And I thought that was an awful idea. Because I thought it was going to be about our baby's cute and, you know,
Goo goo
that
gaga.
Sort of thing. Yeah. Goo goo gaga. Yeah. Exactly what I thought. In fact, my exact words. So I didn't kind of know what to do with it. But then it occurred to me that this was now, and in the late 60s and in the 70s, there were a bunch of sort of new wave movies like Darling and Georgie Girl They were all about sort of free living. Suddenly, the new world had new rules. You could sort of be in a relationship and you could not, and you could, you know, split up with somebody, and you could, you know, you could hook up with somebody and do that for a while and go on, and not being committed seemed to be kind of the nature of all these characters. There was like this new. Sexual revolution going on that allowed for all that. And I noticed that every one of these movies, in the last reel, the heroine got pregnant. I thought it was kind of funny. But then I thought, well, why do they do that? Because you can have the real world with the sexual revolution and all sorts of free love. A baby nails it. A baby says, oh, this is reality. Yeah. Do I really care about that person? Am I going to stay with that person? Who am I really? Who is that person to me? What is our relationship really? Mm-hmm. As soon as there's a baby, you can't fake, you can't lie about your relationship. You can't hide it. You can't obscure it. You have. So then I thought, okay, what the baby is the catalyst to couples coming to terms with each other. And then that became a story. And so that's mm-hmm. where it all came from. I mean, having that in mind, we went to work on it. It was an original story. And with an original story, particularly a story that's based on a concept more than particular people doing something, right. You had unlimited possibilities. They could be anybody.
Right.
You know, which couple on the entire face of the earth are you going to pick? We knew we were going to have an older couple, a sort of middle couple. David and his wife had a tremendously difficult time getting pregnant, so they had gone through that the horrors of sex by the book and all of that. So we knew that one couple was going to do that. We knew we were going to have a younger couple that was going to face it with just the dodo ignorance that anybody places who has a child early on, and then an older couple who somehow were confronting a pregnancy at the moment late in life pregnancy, right. where the kids are off to college and suddenly. You have the empty nest, and then what happens? What happens to them? And so we slowly constructed that. We went through two or three different book writers along the way before we found Sybil Pearson, mm-hmm. and they all contributed something. We actually presented it to Jules Pfeiffer. You can imagine what the show would have been like with a Jules Pfeiffer. But we met, and he said, "Well, I really love the songs, but you have to understand that I've just written a play where, in the last scene, the couple throw a baby out the window, and I think that's a happy ending."
Wow!
So we decided he was not our guy.
My goodness!
But people, you know, different people. Came in and finally we found Sybil Pearson.
How important is that collaboration process? I mean, you can write, you can do a show by yourself, you could try to do it all, but to collaborate with another artist, you know, even going through book writers that maybe weren't perfect for the project, but yet you still got something out of it. Mm-hmm. How important is that collaboration process?
Well, you have to understand that you're not collaborating on something the end result of which is known. Mm. So the process is everything. We're hearing the national anthem playing in behind.
We should tell our listeners we're in a rehearsal studio, and sometimes we hear loud acting happening, but today it's the national anthem that's wafting through our halls.
It's so strange.
Well,
sorry.
I feel like I should stand.
The whole idea is you keep asking the questions and the answers slowly start to emerge. You know, took a long time before we decided to place it on a college campus because suddenly we had a location in which different age groups could somehow intermingle. Why do they know each other? Where do they know each other from? What kind of jobs do they have? And, you know, so that all took a great deal of time. And it's about talking about what the show is about and how it's going to kind of define itself. And pretty much along the way you decide, you can get a sense of whether you're all working together. It's hard to get three creative people who come from different disciplines or different interests to to see one single vision. I was directing it, so my vision tended to prevail, but I kept opening up the doors to other things. My vision actually involved mostly saying, that isn't right. What is right? You know, that isn't deep enough. That isn't, you know. I didn't know what the answer was, but I knew that we hadn't done it. And there was a great exploratory process. I mean, all you're a beginner on every musical you start, whatever principles you learned on the last thing don't apply to this one. In this particular case, we did a workshop. We did, it was exciting. And some people actually, you know, prefer it to the show we ended up with. But there was an overtone that I kept hearing from people, which is that it seemed to be saying that babies ruin lives, which wasn't the message we wanted to say at all. And we realized after a while that drama is conflict. Drama is conflict. But if the issue is a baby, you don't have the same kind of conflict. Your heart may be saying, you stupid woman, why did you screw up and why are you pregnant? And your mouth says, oh, I couldn't be happier. You're just absolute, you know, you're the only person I love. You just don't go at each other when the issue is a baby.
Yeah.
So suddenly the scenes became filled with subtext of everybody not talking about what they're really talking about. Seems to be a theme we have here going. people not talking about it. But I mean, that it became a different kind of drama because the progress of the plot led all of the couples to confront who they were in the most naked way that they ever would. I don't think that any musical ever has had such emotional nakedness in it as the last 40 minutes of Baby, as they all sort of confront who they really are.
It's a beautiful piece of musical theater, and I know you went back a few years afterwards, and there was a revision done at Paper Mill. Is that correct?
Well, we were going to do it at Roundabout. We did a and then we thought. I mean, one of the things that had always bothered us, and we heard it a couple of times from other people, was that it was an all white show. I mean, we wrote about who we knew, and we were all white people. So, we wondered whether or not there was any variation we could make on that. So Charles Randolph Wright, who was a friend of mine, I asked him if he wanted to direct it, and I talked to him about it, and he said, well, no, the issues are, you know, the issues are the same. We did a workshop with, oh God, I can imagine this cast. It was Anika Nani Rose and Chad Kimball with the young kids. LaShawn's and Norm Lewis were the middle couple, and Vicky Clark and John Dossett were the old couple.
Wow, I'd like to see that.
And in the next 3 years, all the women won Tony Awards.
Yeah,
That's amazing.
And then Roundabout still didn't do it. So that was pretty much the production that we allowed Paper Mill to do.
Right. Unfortunately, our time is up for today because we
got to Baby.
We got to Baby. I'm hoping, would you be willing to do a part two with us to cover
sure.
everything else?
Listen, you press a button and I talk.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.